Thank you, everyone, for coming. It's nice to see you all here, several old friends and several new people. And I'd like to introduce Professor Marek Strokov, and he's going to tell us all about the oceans and all sorts of things to do with them. I also wanted to tell you that we will have this this talk on the website, so if you want to refer to it again, or you know someone who has been able to come along, please go on to the website. Details of how to find it are on the board. And there are also two other of the science meetings also on the website, so you can see the talk about God and DNA, and the talk on the wonder of nature and wonder in nature by Ruth Mankiewicz. So do explore that. There are also some notes and other pieces of literature about the talk and by Marek, which are on the table beside the books for sale. And they're free, so if you can get there in time, please grab one of them. So Dr. Hugh Reynolds is going to introduce Marek, and he's going to tell us a little bit about his experience. Thank you.
Thank you, Joy. As I guess you know, this is one of the local groups of Christians in Science, and it's very appropriate that Marek should be our speaker tonight, as he's one of the trustees of Christians in Science. That's how I first got to know him. Does it? Oh, that would make sense. Yeah. I could hear myself, but maybe you couldn't. I'm sorry. I was saying, Professor Strokos is one of the trustees of Christians in Science, of which this is a local group meeting here. So it's a great pleasure to welcome him here tonight. Marek studied at the University of Bristol, where he took a PhD in applied mathematics. Since then, he's been at the University of Southampton, and also sometimes sailing the ocean wave, as he'll probably tell us. He's the professor of physical oceanography at the National Oceanography Centre, and he's also involved in the Southampton Marine and Maritime Institute, where he coordinates the Rapid Climate Change Programme. Marek was the associate director of the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion. As well as publishing and writing many scientific articles that have been published, he's also written several on science and religion, science and faith. And one that I particularly appreciated was entitled Humility and Neglected Scientific Virtue? So it's my pleasure now to hand over to Professor Strokos and ask him to present his lecture, which you can read probably better than I can from my notes, Oceans, Climate Change and Christianity, God's Story and the Earth's Story. Over to Marek.
Thank you very much for inviting me to speak. So I think the title is sort of self-explanatory. I did have another title as well, which may become more apparent as the talk goes on. What will happen the day after tomorrow? I'll leave you to ponder that. So first thing is a job for you. There are three pictures on there, A, B, and C. I would like you to take a minute to think which is the odd one out and why. Which picture is the odd one out and why? And then I'll get you to vote in a minute. Right, okay, you've had your minute. Well, probably less than a minute, but anyway. So, those who think A is the odd one out, would you raise your hands? Okay, right. B? C? Oh, the majority think C is the odd one out. So, C is. Why is C the odd one out? Anybody? No?
Lack of ocean.
Lack of ocean, yeah.
Was it you, the other two? You were in both the other pictures at some point?
No. So, C. Why do people think B? Not many people voted for B. That's obviously a younger version of myself stood on the deck The reason I'm wearing the orange suit is if you fall in the North Atlantic, you don't last very long. That's a survival suit. So that if you're working on deck and you go overboard, well, first of all, they can spot you because you're bright orange, hopefully, and pick you up. And secondly, you actually will survive longer than the couple of minutes that the water temperatures would kill you. Actually, the odd one out is A, in fact, because most people, when they think about oceanography, think about, they've watched Blue Planet, and they think oceanography is about swimming with whales and dolphins. That's how most people think oceanography works. I'm what's known as a physical oceanographer, which Hugh introduced me. Physical oceanographer doesn't mean I work out, it means I do physics, as opposed to biology or chemistry. And in fact, both these pictures are on the ship. So this is a colleague of mine, Katja. We were doing computer simulations on the cruise to plan how we were going to collect the data. So we're running a computer program to simulate the bit of ocean that we're in. This is me on deck. We were doing some stuff with equipment. This is actually not an oceanographic picture at all. So just to start, let me just say a little bit about myself. So I started out as an applied mathematician. I worked on wave power in the 1970s when the oil crisis was on. And then I had to get a job, and I got a job in oceanography because I've been working on waves. And since then, I've done a number of things. I work on the Rapid Climate Change Programme, some of which I will explain during this talk. I've been involved with NASA and the European Space Agency using satellites to observe the oceans from space. And I'm interested in the effects of physical processes mixing turbulence on plankton growth in the ocean. I wasn't always a Christian. I didn't start out as a Christian. I went to university in 1973, but became a Christian at university because I was thinking about what does my life mean, what's the point of it all. And at that time, Eastern religions were quite popular, and I investigated various religions and came to the conclusion, actually, that Christianity made the most sense in terms of how I wanted to work and what I thought was true. And as I'm a Christian, I'm trying to understand my faith and what I do as a job. So I'm trying to relate my faith and my work, which I hope will come across in this talk. Now, these two quotes always strike me. Neither of these scientists are Christians. They're, in fact, both atheists, but they say, so Peter Medawar was a Nobel Prize-winning medical man. There are questions that science can't answer, and no conceivable advance in science would empower it to answer. And Sir Martin Rees, who's he's the Astronomer Royal, actually, preeminent mystery is, why does anything exist at all? What breathes life in the equations and actualizes them in a real cosmos? Such questions lie beyond science. They're the province of philosophers and theologians. And I would take that viewpoint that there are things that science can't answer. So I'm a scientist and I do research. There are still questions that we can't answer from science. An example of that would be the how VY question. So this is probably recognizable as a Christmas cake that my wife cooked. So you could describe this Christmas cake in terms of the chemical composition, the biological nature of the fruit in the cake, and all the rest of it, and it still wouldn't explain what it was about. It would explain the science of the cake, even the cooking and what happened, but it wouldn't explain why the cake was made or what the meaning of the story depicted in the figures at the top of the cake were. So science can answer some questions, but it can't answer all questions. So in this talk, I'm going to talk about God's story and the Earth's story, which is the context in which I do my science. So all stories have a beginning and an end and a middle. And God's story, the Bible is essentially God's story. And the Earth's story is embedded in God's story. In Genesis 1, in the beginning, God made the heaven and the earth. And at the end of the Bible in Revelation, it says there'll be a new heaven and a new earth. So we're living in the middle of the story of the earth that God created and is at work in. And as an oceanographer, I like this verse because it makes me feel like I'm doing something to do with God's creation, which is good. God said, let the waters under the sky be gathered to one place. The gathered waters he calls sea, and he saw that it was good. So I'm doing and working in an area that God's good creation. And I particularly like this verse from Psalm 104, or two verses. There is a sea, vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond them, the living things, both large and small. There the ships go to and fro, and Leviathan, which you formed to frolic there. So this is one of our ships outside the Oceanography Centre in Southampton. We go to and fro on the oceans in our ships. And this is a picture taken from one of our ships when I was at sea in 2007, I think. And we were in a force 11 storm. There were 12-metre waves, and a pod of pilot whales came and played around the ship. They body surfed the waves. It was an incredible experience, and, Leviathan is some big sea creature. these sea creatures frolicking in the waves and reminding me of this psalm. So, climate change. We all know that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is going up. This is the record from Hawaii, a famous record of CO2 rising since the 1960s. The little oscillations are the Northern Hemisphere spring, winter, summer cycle. And then we've exceeded recently the 400 parts per million, which hasn't been exceeded previously for 3 million years. 3 million years ago, there was no civilization on this planet and human beings didn't really exist. So we're in a very different situation to what we were then. The thing about CO2 is it warms the planet. Now, that science is not new. That science was done in the 19th century by people like Arrhenius, Fourier, and other people. So there's nothing new about this science. It's 150 to 200 years old, the science of global warming. So when you hear people saying, oh, it's all this modern stuff that people have thought of, actually, we've known this theory for over 150 years, way back into the 19th century. So we're warming the planet because we're putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Now, why are the oceans important? And the oceans are important because water can hold a lot of heat. The top 3 meters of the ocean can hold as much heat as the entire atmosphere. And the oceans are 4 kilometers deep. It's just to do with the thermal capacity of the water, if you remember your physics. And because it's absorbing heat and it's moving it around because of the currents, we can change the climate, or it affects the climate. So the ocean circulation moves heat over huge distances. The North Atlantic releases some of that heat back to the atmosphere, about 1 petawatt, 10 to the 15 watts, which is about 30,000 times the average output of all the UK power stations. So the North Atlantic is putting heat back into the atmosphere. Most of the heat goes in at the equator and comes out elsewhere. So this is Hollywood's take on what I do. No sound. Sorry. What's happened to my sound? Try again.
You recall what you said about how polar melting might disrupt the North Atlantic current?
Yes.
What do I think is happening?
The government has to start making long-term preparations now.
Jack, all you have is a theory.
It's been raining like this for 3 days now.
Mr. Vice President, if we don't act now, it's going to be too late.
What can we do? Save as many as you can.
So, The Day After Tomorrow, a very good film. I enjoyed the film very much. The implication is that if the North Atlantic circulation changes, then we get a Northern Hemisphere ice age. How true is that? So, these things appear in reputable newspapers like the Washington Post. Global warming is now slowing down the circulation of the ocean, with potentially dire consequences. More recently, scientists say global ocean circulation may be vulnerable to shutdown. So these are issues that concern the public. So The Day After Tomorrow, it says in the film, polar melting might disrupt North Atlantic currents. Is that fact or fiction? And should we be worried? What will happen the day after tomorrow? So I want to explore that a bit in this talk. So this is a very simplified picture of the ocean. It's what's known as the ocean conveyor belt picture. Basically, warm water is moving around the ocean, largely from the Pacific Indian Ocean through into the Atlantic. And as it goes north in the Atlantic, the weather systems crossing the Atlantic pick up heat, which gives us a nice temperate climate in the winter. And as the heat is lost from the ocean, the water cools and comes and sinks because it's denser as a deep current and comes back at depth. So this is a great ocean conveyor. And this is what gives us our rather nice temperate climate. Now, with global warming, a number of things are happening. You're warming the oceans, which means that the water coming north is less dense, so even if you cool it, it may not sink. Greenland is melting. A warmer atmosphere holds more moisture, which is why we're getting floods and more rain in places. More rainfall means you get fresh water coming into the ocean. Greenland melting, you've got fresh water coming in. Fresh water makes the ocean less dense. So you may be cooling it, but because it's warmer to start with and you're adding fresh water, it may not sink because it's not getting dense enough. So you could actually shut down this circulation or slow it down. And we know that's happened in the past from things like ice core and sediment records. We know that the ocean circulation has changed in the past and the northern hemisphere has cooled. That's a very simplified picture. This is a picture of some work we did near Africa where the warm water's coming around. These are satellite track buoys. The colours are temperatures from a satellite. And you can see that the currents don't flow in that nice uniform flow, but they flow in very different ways. That buoy went into the Agulhas current and zipped down the coast. So we know that the ocean flow is much more complicated than that simplified picture, but the simplified picture helps us think through some of the issues. So the benefits for us in the UK and Northwest Europe are that if you take a typical winter picture, January 1993 this is, but you could pick any January really, and you look at the air temperatures in the Northern Hemisphere, and if you look at this latitude belt where we are, this line, you can see that in Russia, Northwest Europe, around here, back into Canada, it is about 10 degrees colder in winter than it is in our locality, and that is because the warm water coming north in the Atlantic, the weather systems are picking up heat, and us and Norway particularly benefit from that heat. But potentially that could be disrupted. Let's skip that. Sorry. So what are we doing in the Oceanography Centre? What we're interested in is what is happening to this system, and we have chosen, for reasons that I'll explain in a minute, to monitor the ocean at about 26.5 north, where we can work out what's happening in the ocean in terms of warm water going north and cooler water coming back down south. These big arrows represent the weather systems picking up heat from the water. So when we talk about the ocean circulation, we measure in a unit called a sverdrup, which is a million cubic meters per second. The entire global input of fresh water from rivers into the ocean is one sverdrup. Ocean currents like the one that I showed you near Africa, the Agulhas Current, is 70 sverdrups. The Gulf Stream is about 30 sverdrups at the Florida Strait, and then as it picks up more fluid, it rises to about 150 sverdrups further upstream, further downstream, sorry. So these are huge amounts of water. A million cubic meters of water per second is a lot of water to be shifting around. And associated with that flow is the heat content of the water. So I'm going to talk to you a bit about the RAPID program. So what follows, I'm very grateful to my colleagues at NOC. This is not all my work, it's work by colleagues at NOC, at the Oceanography Centre, and by the in the RAPID program. And if you want to look up more, there's a website you can go and have a look at. So to work out what's happening in the ocean, the traditional way we do that is we take a ship and we go across the ocean, say at about 26 north, which is where we're monitoring. And every 50 kilometres we stop and we lower instruments all the way to the bottom. And by doing that, we can construct a picture like this, which basically the top 1,000 metres is expanded a bit because there's more going on in the top 1,000 metres. The ocean's about 6.5 kilometres deep. That's the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. This end, we have the Bahamas. This end, we have the Canaries. I think it's the Canaries, anyway. Tenerife and so on. And we can work out what the temperature is doing and what the saltiness of the water is doing, and we can look at the structure of the ocean. Now, if you go into, this has been done, this is one of the most regularly observed parts of the ocean, and that's been observed in 57, 81, 92, 98, 2004, 2010, 2015, about every 5 to 10 years. And obviously, this is not a practical system for monitoring what's going on all the time. So if the ocean circulation is going to change, we need a different way of monitoring. We can't do this all the time. It takes about 35 days to do this on the ship and 20-odd scientists. So it's not a, you couldn't be sending scientists backwards and forwards every 35 days. It's just not practical. So what we're doing is we have put in an array of observations. And essentially, we have buoys, moorings, which are basically long pieces of wire, 5 kilometers of wire with a weight on the bottom and a buoy on the top, with instruments that can measure the temperature and salinity of the ocean. And we have those at the east, western side, at the eastern side, and either side of the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. And we also measured the flow of the Gulf Stream through the Florida Straits using an undersea telephone cable. Because water is a conducting fluid and the Earth's got a magnetic field, the flow of water through the Florida Straits induces a voltage difference across the strait, which we can measure and calibrate against the flow in the strait. So using this, we can work out how much warm water is going north and how much cold water is going south. And we're essentially using something that you would be familiar with. We're using, I'll just show you this. This is an example of a mooring, just to give you the scale. So it's 5 kilometres of wire. It's not to scale in terms of the size of the buoys on it, but in terms of the height it is. So you've got a weight, you've got buoyancy, which is the yellow stuff. Then you've got instruments attached to it at various places. You've got what's known as an acoustic release. So we drop this over the back of the ship, and then when we come back and send an acoustic signal, it releases the weight and it comes back to the surface. We can recover it. But just to give you the scale, this is the Empire State Building. This is the Eiffel Tower, and that's a typical house, is that little dot. So they're big pieces of kit that we're putting in the water. And we're using a system based on what's known as geostrophy, which is a balance between the pressure gradient. That's happened to my picture. Keeps going. Okay. A balance between the pressure gradient and the effects of the Earth's rotation on the flow. You'll be familiar with this from your weather forecast. Fluid should move from high pressure to low pressure. And if you look on your weather map, you have isobars, and the flow is along the isobars, and that's because the Earth rotates. So the rotation of the Earth deflects the flow along the isobars. And we're essentially doing the same by measuring the temperature of salinity, which is that gives us density. Density gives us pressure. We can measure the pressure difference across the ocean, just like you can on your weather map, work out what the flow is. This has been known for years by Ballast's law, goes back to the 19th century. If the wind is at your back in the northern hemisphere, the low pressure is on your left, just by that simple geostrophic balance. And that's what we're using to make those measurements. And that's what we've been doing for 10 years. I'm going to show you a bit more of this, a bit more up-to-date data. But for the first 5 years, not a lot happened. You have the seasonal changes. So this is the circulation, how much warm water is going north and how much cold water is coming south. And it's about 18 sverdrups with seasonal variations. The big surprise was that in 2009-10, we had this big dip, 30% dip in the circulation. And then we carried on measuring till 2014. And actually, if you look over the whole record, there's been a slow decline in the circulation over that period. So two things, really, from these observations. One is that we have seen this big change in the circulation. And the second thing is that we have seen this slow decline over 10 years. I'm going to skip that. The big decline in 2009-10 was associated with one of the coldest winters that we had. I don't know whether you remember, airports shut down. There was a big snow everywhere in the UK, which is quite unusual. This is a very unusual picture because you can see the whole of the UK, which you usually can't because it's cloud covered. And you can see that the whole of the UK is snowed over. And the ocean circulation slowing down isn't the complete explanation why we had a very cold winter, but it contributed to make that winter colder because the ocean wasn't bringing as much heat north because it had slowed down. Therefore, the weather systems crossing it weren't picking up as much heat. I'm going to skip this. So what we found is that we've been observing the ocean. We found some surprises in the observations. We found that there are some short-term impacts. We're interested in long-term change in terms of climate. The ocean circulation is slowing down, which is what we might expect with climate change. But we have an observational record that's too short to be sure what's going to happen. I'll talk about that a bit more in a minute. Let me just remind myself what I'm supposed to be showing you next. Okay, so what I'm going to do is show you a little video. So is the sound going to work for this? Okay, this little video shows what we do at sea, just so you've got some idea of how this all works.
The North Atlantic is particularly sensitive to changes in temperature and salinity. The circulation here is complex and known as the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation.
Okay.
Cold water returns south at depth, completing the circulation. Mount Tidy on the island of Tenerife, the highest point in the Atlantic Ocean. Scientists are on the island for the start of the rapid climate change expedition. They'll spend the next month deploying an array of 22 scientific moorings across the Atlantic between Africa and the tip of Miami. The instruments will measure the overturning circulation on a daily basis. Until this expedition, scientists had little idea how this circulation varied year on year, let alone every day. They sail along latitude 26.5 degrees north. This is where the ocean transports most heat northwards. Preparations are underway to deploy a mooring. Instruments and buoys are attached to cables that stream out behind the ship. This takes many hours.
I'll give you a shout when the first buoy's arrived.
That's the weight at the bottom.
Dragged up to 5 kilometers down to the sea floor. The instruments will spend a year in unforgiving conditions. Deep beneath the ship, the instruments find anchorage on Africa's continental slope. The slopes give way to the abyssal plain. 3,000 kilometers ahead lies a vast mountain range, deep beneath the surface, the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. The team deploy instruments on either side. Another 2,000 kilometers and the scientists reach the continental shelf of the United States. After deploying the array, the researchers return once more across the Atlantic. This time they stop every 50 kilometers and lower instruments to the seabed 5 kilometers below. This takes many hours. The instruments sample the water at different depths. Unlike the array deployed earlier, which will provide continuous daily measurements of the circulation, these instruments are hauled back to the surface once they've captured the various water samples. These samples provide a valuable reference point for the new array. This is only the fifth such transatlantic snapshot taken since 1957. After a year of constant operation, the scientists retrieve the instruments. This is a tense time. Will the instruments resurface as instructed? Or has a year under immense pressure proved too much? It sometimes takes a whole day to locate and retrieve a mooring.
A buoy about 50 meters starboard side, towards the stern.
Scientists waste no time checking each instrument and recovering the valuable data. It's a success. Most instruments work perfectly. The team have now pieced together the first year's data. On the 17th of August 2007, the Rapid Climate Change Program announced the first continuous daily measurements of the strength of the overturning circulation in two landmark papers in the American journal Science. It seems circulation varies considerably from day to day, much more than expected. Policymakers and researchers are already using the results, and it has inspired educators and artists, writers and filmmakers.
So the film was made early on in the programme, so it talks about five transects, and we've done a couple more since then. And it also talks about the first year of data. We've now got 11 and a half years of data, but it gives you a feel for what the sort of things we are doing at sea and how the programme works. So basically we go out, put out one set of equipment, leave it there, go back and collect it. We have two sets of equipment. We replace it with a new set, bring the stuff back to the lab, download all the data, refurbish all the batteries and all the things that need refurbishing, put it back in the water. And we've been doing that since 2004. So we now have 11 and a half years of data, and currently my colleagues are actually at sea getting the next 18 months. We've gone over to changing every 18 months now rather than every year. There's some practical reasons why that makes life easier. So this is what I showed you before, the first 10 years. And we had that sort of decline with that big dip in 2009-10. And the next 18 months' data showed something different. They show a sort of flattening out. So what's going to happen next? What will happen the day after tomorrow? When my colleagues come back from this cruise, we'll have another 18 months to add on to the end of this. It'll be interesting to see, will this then continue to go down, or will it start to go up, or will it flatten out? Whichever it does, it's interesting, because we've never had these measurements before. This is the first time this has been done in the oceans. This is a unique program in terms of what it's doing. So, what will happen the day after tomorrow? The film is not correct in saying there's going to be a Northern Hemisphere ice age. Global warming will continue, but the ocean will affect where the heat goes, so you could get cooling locally. It just means the heat is going somewhere else. So if you average over the planet, you're still warm. It's just you may get cooler here and warmer here. And I think that's one of the misunderstandings that people have about global warming is people think 2 degrees warming will be very nice. We'll grow grapes in southern England, have vineyards, etc. In actual practice, it could be plus 10, minus 10, or plus 10, minus 6, you know, in different places relative to present-day conditions. So it's not uniform, but on average, the planet will warm. So I just want to talk a little bit about what's going on now, more generally, apart from that particular program, which I'm particularly involved in. We know the world is warming, so these are the surface temperatures relative to 61 and 1990. And as you can see, the temperatures continuing to rise. There are ups and downs, and that's because the system varies for reasons which are not to do with global warming. And the so-called hiatus, which everybody went on about, who said that global warming was a made-up thing, that hiatus is just this little bit here, and it's gone up again, which is what we expected scientifically. If you just put together various factors that are involved in global warming, you would expect at times that things might slow down, speed up, and in fact, at sometimes they might appear even to be cooling temporarily, but overall the trend is upwards. And in fact, the 10 warmest years on record, bar 1998, are all in this century. And in fact, all since 2003. So the planet is definitely warming. The other thing that the ocean is doing is it's absorbing carbon dioxide. Now, we're putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere because we're using fossil fuels. About 33% of the carbon dioxide that we put into the atmosphere is going into the ocean. 50% stays in the atmosphere, and the rest is taken up by the terrestrial biosphere, plants and trees and so on. And there are two mechanisms that the ocean uses. One is what's called the solubility pump. The fact is CO2 dissolves in the water. It actually makes it more acidic, so the ocean is acidifying, which has consequences for things like these coccolithophores who have calcium carbonate shells, and that can dissolve in acid. So there's a consequence for the biology. So that's the solubility pump. Also, CO2 that's absorbed into the ocean is used by phytoplankton to grow, just like plants on land use carbon dioxide. So some of it goes into the biology of the ocean, and because that some of those things die and sink into the ocean, carbon dioxide is captured into the ocean. So the ocean CO2, the atmospheric CO2 would have gone up a lot faster without the ocean. So this is a picture of where the heat is going. So we're heating the planet, but where's the heat going? Well, 7% of it is going into the land and ice and air, which is why the atmosphere is warming. But 93% of it is actually going into the ocean. The ocean, because of its high thermal capacity, which I mentioned earlier, is absorbing 93% of the excess heat. If we had no oceans, the planet would be several degrees warmer by now. The oceans have a buffering capacity in taking the heat, which would go into the atmosphere otherwise. So the oceans are warming. This has implications for distribution of plankton and fish species because those are sensitive to temperature. It has an impact on hurricane formation because hurricanes depend on drawing energy from the ocean, and the ocean is warming, which means there's more energy for hurricanes to form. The evidence currently seems to suggest that we won't get more hurricanes, but we'll get stronger hurricanes. But that's an area of active research. When I was in Iceland at a conference a few years ago, the Icelanders were worried that their cod were moving outside the 200-mile limit, and which is a big part of their economy. They're not sure why that's happening. It's either happening because the temperatures are rising and cod are temperature sensitive, or it's possible that the plankton that the cod feed on are temperature sensitive and the cod are following the food source, but we're not absolutely sure. So these things have practical effects. Coral reefs, we've probably heard a lot about the dieback of the Great Barrier Reef. That's probably more caused by the current El Niño, La Niña conditions in the Pacific than global warming, but global warming will have the same effect. You're warming the waters, corals are temperature sensitive, and that can lead to coral bleaching. Likewise, ocean acidification can affect corals and how they work. So the other thing that's happening, which we should be concerned about, is sea level is rising. So this is the record, largely based on satellite observations of sea surface height globally since the 1990s, when we've had satellites to do this. And over this period, it's been rising at about 3 millimetres per year. I'm not quite sure why my picture keeps disappearing. Over the 20th century, which is a longer record based on tide gauges and more uncertainty, it's probably been rising at least at 1.7 millimetres per year. And the projection is that by the end of this century, it will have risen by a metre. Now, that might not seem very much, except if you're in Bangladesh. If you're in Bangladesh, this is the 1 metre contour. This delta is very fertile, and about 10 million people live in this delta because they can grow food there. If you raise the sea level by 1 metre by the end of this century, that means 10 million refugees. Actually, probably means more because the population will have increased in that period as well. So in places like this, a 1 metre sea level rise is a serious problem. It's maybe not so much of a serious problem here in Purley or even in Southampton. It's a potential problem in the Thames and London. The Thames barrier is currently being raised about 20 times a year, I believe, because the storm surges are also increasing. It was designed to be raised 3 or 4 times a year, I think, or something like that. At some point, the Thames barrier may not hold back the sea level rises. The other thing is, if you look at it globally, you see that in Asia, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of land area near sea level. There is in North America as well, but the population is much smaller. So if you raise the sea level by a meter, you would affect a large number of people in Asia, less so in Africa and Europe and Australia. The other thing that's happening is the Arctic sea ice is melting. This line here is what the median sea ice extent in September is for, on average, from 79 on median from 79 to 2000. And this was what it was in 2012, which is the minimum sea ice extent that we've had. And you can see this is a January through December. The minimum sea ice is usually in September. This green curve at the bottom is the 2012. The red one is 2016. So, and these are the mean sea ice extent with some uncertainties over that period. So you can see that in more recent years, the sea ice is disappearing, and it's projected to disappear sometime completely this century in the summer. Well, probably in September at the end of the summer, which is when the maximum melt is. And we're not quite sure when. Estimates vary from in the next 10, 20 years through to towards the end of the century. And you get things like this Time magazine, Be Worried, Be Very Worried, and your poor polar bear, which hunts off sea ice, may not be able to hunt. And although polar bears are actually not very nice creatures, because if you meet one, it'll eat you. But they are iconic in that they are rather cuddly looking and cute, particularly the cubs. So I've talked to you a bit about the science. I just want to finish by talking about what should our response be? Is there a Christian view? And you may have heard about the Pope made comments on this. He published an encyclical called Laudato Si. I'm not sure I pronounced that right, On Care for Our Common Home, and it was considered quite controversial in some circles that the Pope spoke out on this. And should the Pope be an eco-warrior? And he seems to be an eco-warrior in the sense he's speaking out about creation care. You know, a Christian who does not respect creation is a Christian who does not care about the work of God. So I want to go back to God's story and the earth story. I made the point that God made the heavens and earth in the first place, and that Revelation, we see the new heavens and the new earth. So what will happen the day after tomorrow? From a Christian point of view, eschatologically, ultimately, last times, there'll be a new heaven and a new earth. But what should we be doing now? So if you look at the story, you have creation, the fall, you have Israel's, God's Old Testament people, Jesus, birth, death, and resurrection, the church, God's people in the New Testament, Jesus returns, and then there's a new creation. So there's a sort of trajectory from creation through to Jesus and then out to new creation. And if you read Romans, it says things like this: creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it in hope, that the creation itself would be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. So God's expectation for the world is that in the end, there will be a better world, a recreation of the world. But God has a plan, he's got a purpose, he's working out this purpose. His plan is to rescue all of creation. We tend to think as Christians sometimes that it's all about rescuing us as sinners or people who need saving. But actually, God's interested not just as individuals, but he's interested in his creation and what's happening to it. So, you know, he's interested in the people and the planet. And the key question to me then is, how should we, if we're Christians, how should we live? Should that bring a response from us in terms of how we live? So when I get to this point, I always like to go back to Jesus because that's the basis of my faith. You know, there are all sorts of ways you can look at scripture, but I like to go back to fairly simple things, and I go back to Jesus' two commandments. So Jesus' greatest commandment was to love God. So the earth, he's sort of given to us to look after, but ultimately it belongs to him. It says in the Psalms, the earth is the Lord's and all that it contains. And I like Christopher Wright's comments. Trashing someone else's property is incompatible with any claim to love the other person. If I borrow this gentleman's phone and jumped on it, I won't do that, but if I did, I was his friend, he might not consider me much of a friend if I just smashed up his phone. You know, and we're doing that to God's creation. We are not caring for the creation that God has given us. And you can argue whether we are expressing love to God in the way we're treating our planet. And our treatment of the earth will be a measure of our relationship with the Creator, which I think is quite a challenging comment from Christopher Wright. So first commandment, love God. That makes us think about how we should care for creation. The second commandment is love your neighbour. So are our actions causing harm to others elsewhere on the planet? And the answer is the Western world has largely been responsible for carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, industrial development, use of fossil fuels. I know China is catching us up and other people are. But the reality is where we are now is largely due to us as Westerners, not due to China or India. So the question is, our CO2 emissions are causing global warming, that causes sea level rise, droughts, floods, that leads to environmental refugees. The biggest impact of global warming is on the poor. It's not on us in the West. And the Bible has a lot to say about caring for the poor. And actually, a lot of those people out there in Africa and other places are my brothers and sisters as Christians. So as a Christian, I have a concern for those people out there in the world. So those are the sort of things that make me think about what my response is to the things I'm doing as a scientist, but also to how I'm living as a Christian. To me, God's story and the earth's story, the whole of Scripture, present this challenge to understand what we're doing to the earth. That's my scientific understanding. And then how should we live as a response to that? And how to live in a way that cares for both God's creation in terms of the planet, but also for the people on the planet. Both are important, and I think both need to be thought about. I think I'm almost done. What should our response be? I think that's the question I'd like to leave you with. It's not going to be the last thing I show you, but I think I'd like you to go away and think, not just this is good, interesting science, but I'd like you to think as a Christian, if you're a Christian, maybe not all Christians, but if you're a Christian, I would say, what do you take those commandments, love God and love your neighbour, and how does that impact your life today in these areas? So I'm just going to show you a little film which I find quite amusing. This works.
You ought to stop fishing in the ice like that. The size of that hole is causing climate change.
How do you figure that out?
Well, you've been fishing like that for as long as I can remember, and climate change is happening, so that must be causing it.
No, that's not causing climate change. Climate change is caused by fishing with synthetic lines like that one you've got.
No, I don't think that's it. I think it's your position. See, you're facing east. You need to not be facing east.
Not be facing east? That sounds a bit far-fetched. I think it's the blue hat you're wearing that's causing climate change.
My blue hat?
Yeah, it's clear. Well, maybe not, but what else could possibly be causing climate change?
Maybe it's the humans.
The humans?
Yeah.
No. Do you think for one moment that they would allow that to happen to us?
Oh, it's got to be the hats then.
Yeah, it must be the hats.
I mean, a serious point is that, you know, people say all sorts of things about climate change, but the reality is that we're putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We've known for 200 years, 150 years, the science is that if you put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the planet will warm. That will have consequences. There are consequences already occurring around the world in terms of sea level rise and other factors. And I think for us as Christians, if we're Christians, we need to think about what that means. And I would like to end with this final slide. It'd be great that one day the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Thank you very much for listening. So I'm happy to answer questions.
Right, do we have any questions?
The gentleman at the back there.
Yeah, what do you feel about the new American administration when Donald Trump says climate change has been quoted as a hoax, and also the power and effect of economics, jobs, because we're linked into oil, coal, gas, whole of our economy depends on it. Any thoughts on that?
Well, two separate questions. One is, what do I think of the Trump administration? Well, I could use various words, but probably not in polite company. I think the reality is that there is a large section of America which is what I would call climate deniers. And if you read a book by Naomi Oreskes, which is called Merchants of Doubt, she catalogues over the last 50 years how various right-wing and business interests in the States have tried to dismiss claims. They started off with smoking doesn't cause cancer, acid rain isn't real, secondary smoking doesn't cause cancer, blah, blah, I can't remember this. She's got about six examples, the latest of which is climate change. There are people vested interest in the US ploughing huge amounts of money in trying to discredit climate change, which they've tried to discredit with other scientific findings in the past because it undermines their businesses. I think that is a disaster for the world, to be honest. Trump is influenced by those people. He's clearly wrong scientifically, and as are they, there's no doubt about that. But they have power, and as you've probably realised, fake news or alternative facts, as his spokesperson said, are the order of the day. I think that's very sad and unfortunate, and so on. With regard to the economy, there's some evidence, and I'm not an expert on the economy, that if you move towards a green economy, which some places are doing so, and in fact America was doing so under Obama, actually there are business opportunities in a green economy that don't exist in a standard economy, and at some point we will run out of coal and oil, so we're going to have to move to something else anyway. Some companies who are more far-sighted have actually thought about investing in alternative ways of producing energy. And in fact, the ironic thing is America is in a good place to do that. It's got lots of deserts, so it can do lots of solar power in a way that we would find more difficult given our climate. I don't think the economic argument is really true. In fact, one of the most interesting things about the film The Day After Tomorrow, for those of you who watched it, the most interesting bit of it is when the guy presents his results at a conference, the vice president of the United States who's present and looks strikingly like Dick Cheney, who was the president, vice president at the time, says that, you know, if we stop putting out CO2, our economy will be ruined. And in fact, that's the most realistic part of the film, in the sense of that's what the argument was being put forward by Dick Cheney at that time. I think it's not true. I don't think that our economy will be ruined. I think the people who would struggle in the short term is probably not so much the Western economies, but possibly places like India and China, the developing nations. But we're working, the UK is working with China on carbon capture and storage. So, you know, to try and, you know, if you are going to use fossil fuels, can you capture the carbon and stop it going into the atmosphere? So I think there are ways forward. But sadly, the Trump administration don't seem to be very interested, which is a pity.
Anyone else?
Thank you. You ended with a Christian hope, yep, which I share. Do you have a sort of proximate hope from a scientific point of view as well? Looking not at Revelation and 21, but looking at the science and the political systems in which we're all caught and the power of global corporations in our world, how hopeful are you that we can turn things around?
Well, when the Paris Agreement happened and people signed up to that, and China and people like that signed up who hadn't in the past, I was quite positive. I'm still quite positive because China and others have said basically we'll ignore what the Americans are doing and carry on. So I think I'm quite hopeful that there seems to be agreement across the world, with the exception of the USA at the moment, and they were agreed prior to Trump coming to power. I think we could cut our carbon emissions. The UK, I think it's the current Climate Change Act says by 2050 we'll cut our carbon emissions by 80%. I think there are signs of hope. The problem is immediate politics actually tends to blank out long-term politics. Most politicians won't be around in 2050. Well, I probably won't be around in 2050, to be honest. So, you know, they're not really thinking with that sort of viewpoint. And if there's a problem more immediate, like getting through the next election, they'll change their tune to help them do that. Some of them, not all politicians. I'm not trying to tar all politicians. So I'm sort of semi-hopeful. And I think there's still... I'm still messing around with this, aren't I? What I'm doing here. I think there's still hope. But, you know, politics is inherently unpredictable. I mean, who would predict that Trump would win? I mean, that was, I think, a big surprise to a lot of people. So, you know... I don't know. I mean, I'd like to remain hopeful because the Paris Agreement was signed by so many countries, including China, who previously hadn't signed up. So, and they're the biggest. They're not the biggest emitter per person. They're the biggest emitter total because just they're so big now. So.
Thank you very much for that. I've long been convinced about climate change, but I'm still a little unsure as to whether it's man-made. We haven't discussed the relative proportions of CO2 emission by man against, for instance, volcanic activity. I know there's a positive driver in that as the oceans warm, I believe they release dissolved carbon dioxide. But on the other hand, as the carbon dioxide levels go up, plants become more efficient at capturing it. There have been cases, for instance, of greenhouses in the Netherlands where they deliberately introduce higher levels of carbon dioxide to feed photosynthesis. Have we got evidence as to how these positive and negative drivers balance? And then, if it is man-made, are we in a position to do anything about it when China has for some time been building about 2 new coal-fired power stations a week? They may have slowed down a bit on that.
So, I mean, there's no doubt scientifically that human beings are responsible for the emission of CO2 into the atmosphere. The other sources are such that they are not significant factors. If you run a climate model without the CO2 in the atmosphere that human beings have put there since the Industrial Revolution, the planet does not warm in the models. And that's a range of models from different countries. So there's absolutely no doubt in my mind, and I think in most scientists' mind, that global warming is a man-made problem. I use the word man advisedly as well, given that most of it's been dominated by men for the last couple of hundred years. So moving on, I don't think there's any doubt that global warming is caused by us as human beings. There's no doubt about that. Other factors, like are there any positive benefits? There may be some positive benefits, you're quite right. There is some evidence for CO2 fertilization of plants. However, that is fairly limited in what it would do. It wouldn't take all the CO2 out of the atmosphere that we've put in, nowhere near. Also, it would only happen in certain places depending on having enough rainfall and so on to grow the plants. And we know that drought is increasing in many places and floods are increasing in many places, neither of which are particularly conducive to growing things. So there are probably some positive benefits, and there are some places in the world where perhaps a 2-degree temperature rise would be beneficial to the local population, but overall on the planet, as I said, it's not going to be a nice uniform 2 degrees. It'll get a lot hotter in some places and not so hot in others. So there are issues like that. And then I've forgotten the final part of your question, which is what can we do about it, or given that China is doing whatever it's doing, okay? So I have some sympathy with the Indian and Chinese argument that we Westerners have grown rich on the CO2 that we've emitted over the last 150, 200 years. And why should they stop emitting when they're trying to catch up economically? It's difficult to say to somebody who's worse off than you generally, well, you know, you're going to have to suffer more. Interesting, like I said earlier, the Chinese are working with the British on carbon capture and storage, so they may be putting things into the atmosphere, but they're also working on how to take it out, which is a positive thing. I'm not sure India is doing something similar, I don't know. So I think the fact that they're building 2 new power stations, whatever, per week is a problem, but I also think it's a problem that they've thought about and are working on trying to solve, because they want to do economic development and tackle the climate change issue, because that's why they signed up to the Paris Agreement. So I think they're more serious about it than the Americans are, to be honest. At the moment, I mean, I think in terms of personal things, I think you can look at it and say this problem is too big, the politicians ought to deal with it, or the big companies ought to deal with it. But I'm not of that viewpoint, because it says in Scripture, nothing that we do to serve God is in vain, 1 Corinthians 15:58, I think. And I think no matter how small a thing you do, if you're contributing in the right direction, you're contributing in the right way. So I've insulated my house, I've downsized my car, I try and travel less by plane. I have to sometimes for my job, ironically. So I've tried, you know, I cycle to and from work. You know, I wouldn't say I'm the ultimate green, because I'm way, I know I've got friends who do much more than I do, but every little thing helps. You know, so, you know, there's a thing, an engineer called Sokolov came up with this idea of, they were called the Sokolov wedges. It's like a slice of pie that you're trying to get rid of. So if we do something about our homes, heating, lighting, that's 10%. If we do something about transport, that's another 10%. And if we work on each slice of the pie, eventually the whole pie is gone. So by working on all these individual areas, and if I'm contributing in my little bit of slice in terms of my home and car and the things I do, you know, I'll let the companies worry about what they're doing with their industrial plants. That's not a problem I can solve, but I can contribute to what I can contribute to, and I think I should do that. Well, the thing is, do I do the right thing because it's the right thing, or do I do the right thing because everybody else is doing it? I think I'd rather do it because it's the right thing.
Right, just 2 more questions.
I don't know where there was. Is somebody with us? I don't know who had their hand up first.
Thank you. I mean, you obviously talked a lot about CO2, but what about other greenhouse gases? And as part of that too, is do you think some of these changes are reversible?
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
Are some of these changes that you've highlighted reversible?
So the reason people concentrate on CO2 is because it stays in the atmosphere a long time. So even if we stopped emitting CO2 now, it would be 200 to 300 years before it all came out of the atmosphere or reduced back to pre-industrial levels by natural processes. Other gases like methane, which things like having cows, I mean, this is an argument for not eating beef and stuff, is that cows emit a lot of methane, and there's a lot of desire for meat. But methane doesn't stay in the atmosphere very long. I think its residence time in the atmosphere is tens of years, so it will come out of the atmosphere a lot faster. So some of these other things do affect global warming, but they're more easily got rid of out of the atmosphere than CO2. We can reduce CO2. I mean, carbon capture and storage is seriously being researched, where even if you are emitting CO2, you capture it and maybe pump it back into the oil wells deep under the ocean that you've emptied of oil under pressure so it's liquid. They're growing more plants rather than cutting down the rainforests, growing more rainforests and stuff like that. There are limits to what you can do in that direction because the carbon uptake with plants seems to be largely in the early stages of growth, so in the first few years when they're growing rapidly. So there are things we can do to reduce the carbon in the atmosphere. There are people working on those things, but they're not of the scale yet where we can solve the problem using those techniques. So, yeah.
I just want to ask you, sir, sometimes in gloomy moments, I think the human race was the biggest disaster to the planet. That may sound irreverent.
No.
Could I ask you this? What would be the best ways of tackling global warming, the kind of sources of energy to maintain a civilization with speedy movement and that kind of thing, and medical science? People speak about renewables. There's nuclear energy. What would you envisage as the best means of energy?
Well, if we had a perfectly peaceful world where we could all live in... Why am I rattling? I can't do anything. If we had a very peaceful world in which we didn't fight and have wars, you don't need to pave over very much of the Sahara Desert to produce enough power for all our energy needs forever. I mean, it's only a small bit of the Sahara that we'd need.
Derive what?
Enough energy, electrical energy to power the whole planet. We could move over to an entirely...
Are you thinking in terms of solar panel?
Solar panel, yeah. So,
that's interesting.
So in terms of... We could actually do that. We don't need to. But unfortunately, in terms of energy security and global security, obviously nobody's going to do that because it would be very unsafe and one nuclear bomb on the installation would ruin the world. So, theoretically, we can solve the problem. Practically, because of politics and money and business, there are issues. We can move in that direction. The fact that we're doing more wind power, that works, although people don't like having windmills. I'm not sure why. I think they're quite attractive personally, but some people don't like them. Sir John Horton, who I have a lot of respect for and was the chair of the IPCC Working Group 1, who's a Christian, he suggested at one point that we could use nuclear power in the short term. It's not a long-term solution because you've got to do something with the radioactive materials that you produce longer term, which is tricky. But until we get enough alternative energy in place, we could use nuclear power short term to sort of bridge us over to cut our dependence on fossil fuels.
What about sea power? Some years ago, they were showing these generators under the ocean. Movement of...
Well, I worked on wave power, which is what we did in the 70s. You can build wave power devices, and had we invested from the 70s till now, we probably would have had some practical solutions. We haven't. The other one is tidal power, which when I was a student in Bristol in the 70s, they were talking about building the Severn Barrage. That would have been a 25-year economic project. No government was prepared to invest the amount of money necessary that wouldn't bring a return over 25 years when most of the politicians would be long gone from their posts and have no credit for it. So I think there are things we can do, and we are doing some of those things. You can build zero carbon housing. On our local news in Southampton, there was a project which had been done by a housing association. So they were building houses for people who are not very well off. And they did it not because of the climate change issue, they did it because they could build a zero carbon house with solar panels and recycling of heat and all this sort of stuff. Because the people living in the house would have no electrical or gas bills because it was all self-sufficient. But actually, that would also be beneficial from a global warming point of view because that house produces no CO2. So you can do that. And to do that on a house, and my understanding is to do that from with a new build house is probably an extra £10,000 to £15,000 investment. If I wanted to do that to my house, because I know somebody who's done this to their house, they've retrofitted all this, it cost them about £40,000 to retrofit their house to be energy self-sufficient, whereas if it had been done when it was built. Now, obviously, you can't go back and rebuild all the housing stock, but we could certainly, the government could certainly impose those regulations, but of course, that won't make them popular with the building industry. So there are political, you know, it would be nice to think that there are nice solutions. I think there are solutions, but I think
we have a moral duty, don't we? I mean, to pursue these things and Christian duty as well.
Well, I would say so, yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was very interesting and thought-provoking. Just a little something for you to say thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And one or two notices. Firstly, about our next meeting, which is in August. All the details are on the board. We've got Sir Colin Humphreys talking to us about science and the historicity of the Bible, the Exodus, the long day of Joshua, and the resurrection. So that seems to be packing quite a lot, but he's an excellent speaker, as some of you know, because he's been here, he's spoken twice, and was very popular. So I hope you'll come along and hear him talk again. Again, as I said, the talks are on the church website, and of course we've got another one this year in November, so all the dates are up there. Please do come along and feel free to finish whatever food there is out there as well. So thank you very much for coming. We'll have Hugh's going to say a final prayer, and then we'll all be free to leave. Thank you.
Thank you. Shall we pray? God our Father, thank you for not only creating our fantastic world, but also for entrusting us with looking after it. Please help us to be good and faithful stewards as we seek to serve and honour you, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Thank you, everyone. Good night. Good night.